Hello and welcome to episode 161 of Speak Beastie for October 2nd, 2022. I'm Amy.
I'm Anne.
And I'm Jeff.
And it's Spook Beastie season again. You thought we were over this nonsense, but you're wrong.
No one should ever think that we are over any nonsense. We are not above or below any nonsense at Speak Beastie. We are like
Spook
right.
Beastie.
We are the line. We are the nonsense.
We are the nonsense. That should be our new t-shirts.
Oh, I like that.
I like it.
See if we can get Carolyn to design that.
Well, you know what else is fun is thanking our Speak Beastie Patreon supporter sponsoring this episode. Yamilith D is our sponsor for this episode.
Yeah!
So Yamilith, first of all, thank you for being our supporter on Patreon. That means a lot. And second, if I have pronounced your name incorrectly, then I apologize. I'm finding as I get old, I don't know if it's because I'm getting older or what, but I just, especially here lately, I have not been pronouncing names correctly a lot, and I'm finding that I'm constantly apologizing for it.
Well, regardless of how you pronounce your name, thank you for your support. We literally couldn't do the show without you.
Thank you.
That is true.
All right, let's head into the Phoenix Register.
And now a message from our sponsors.
Hey you! Yes you! The magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint. Just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind-the-scenes features. But wait, there's more. Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs Knees and How.
So there's not a ton of news, but there's a couple things I did find. There's a new merch design out there. And it's the Secrets of Dumbledore Loungefly bag collection. But I don't totally understand how this is related to Fantastic Beasts. If you look at the design of these bags, they're beautiful. It's a backpack, crossbody bag, and wallet. And they all have this design of wizarding books on them. And it's a great design, but not one of the books is Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And I can't really figure out the connection between these bags and Secrets of Dumbledore, other than Lolly likes books and uses them. But that's all I got.
I'm trying to look at the one that has all the book covers on it, and I'm trying to see if I can make out what the covers say. I know that one of them is, oh, I see, one of them is Sonnets of a Sorcerer. That's not Fantastic Beasts. That's that book where if you read it, you can never stop speaking in limericks for the rest of your life, I think.
Yeah.
Achievements and Charming, Weird Wizarding Dilemmas. Okay, so these are all books from the canon Harry Potter books that have been referenced at some point, but these aren't Fantastic Beasts books.
These are books that were designed by Lena Lima for the movie, though. If you look in, actually, the book we're going to be referencing later, the movie Magic book, in the book section, these are the books that Lolly has in her trunk in Bhutan.
Oh, so I was right about the Lolly connection.
So,
well, thank goodness we didn't have to do a whole lot of research to understand the references in the merchandise. Oh, wait, we did have to do that.
Don't you love a tie-in where you have to do homework?
I love when they design these things and they presume knowledge on the part of the consumer. Like, people are going to see this and think, oh, look, Fantastic Beasts. Oh, look, book titles. Oh, these must be books that were used as props in the movie and not brought up at all. What a fantastic idea for merchandise.
I mean, it is, though. It's beautiful. The bag is beautiful. Like, I love the wallet. The crossbody is lovely. But yes, I feel like if you're going to make merch of it, you probably should have made them more of a focal point in the movie. So it's mm-hmm. so people like us who are doing the homework aren't confused.
Like, at least if you're going to use books and make it like the set of books that's in the design, at least make it books that are referenced. Like, make fantastic. Like, we saw the artwork. We talked about it in the last episode, I think it was, where we talked about how the book covers for Lally's book and Newt's book, they didn't, like, to me, the font didn't really look right. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to use that anyway, then you might as well. Because weren't we saying you could put stuff like that on merchandise?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
And now, like, we have that, this.
This could have been so easily solved if they just smacked Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them book somewhere in the middle of the stack. Yeah. Or even, like, The Prophecies of Tycho Dedanus, right? We've seen that book in the films.
Yep.
Something like that would have just made my brain go, oh, yeah, Fantastic Beasts. But, yeah. Like Anne said, they're beautiful bags. I was like, huh?
They're also, we were having a conversation before we even hit record earlier. We were kind of talking back and forth about buying merchandise and talking about whether or not the cost was worth it. And I don't want to speak ill of Loungefly because they make a beautiful product. But when I've seen these things in real life and I've looked at the price tag, there's no way I can justify spending that on a bag.
I can't lie. I own a lot of Loungefly bags.
Same.
The most recent one I got was when we were in Paris, and there is a beautiful glow-in-the-dark Tower of Terror mini backpack that I picked up when we were at Walt Disney Studios. And, like, normally when I'm going to buy a Loungefly, I'm like you, Jeff. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I can't really justify spending, you know, $75-$80 on a backpack. But I saw this, and I literally grabbed it and marched right to the register. Like, no
Before
questions.
Before you could talk yourself out of it, of course.
Yeah, so.
You have to make things. You can't mull things like that over. Like, that has to be an impulse buy, a very expensive impulse buy, or you're going to talk yourself out of it.
Also, we were there with Marjo's friend Charlene, who is an annual pass holder. So she could get me, I think it was a 10% discount on everything. So the sing was a little bit less.
Not bad. I mean, even a 10% discount on something like that is pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So besides merch, there's another event announcement going on for Fantastic Beasts. This one's going to be held at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto on October 28th. And it's part of the ROM, or ROM After Dark series. The Fantastic Beasts event will be a, quote, Halloween spooktacular, according to the museum's website.
I love this.
So tickets are $30, and they include access to the Wonders of Nature exhibit. So,
lovely.
From what I could gather from the website, it's just kind of a cool, like, after-hours event and is themed, and they do all sorts of stuff like refreshments and music and probably different activities and things. And then you can also get into the exhibit. So sounds kind of cool.
That's fun.
I would go to that. I wouldn't spend money on a Loungefly bag necessarily, but I'd pay $30 to go to the Royal Ontario Museum, sure.
Yeah. So for our Canadian friends, might be something cool to check out and let us know.
Yeah, report back.
Yeah, tell us about it. Send us your pictures. So that's it for news. Not a lot.
That's still some good stuff. Good stuff.
And now we have all cleared off our desks and put out some treats for the owls who are coming to deliver our posts. So we have an owl post from Jerry answering the podcast question from episode 160. Jerry says, you asked for comments related to the theory that Vogel was involved in Grindelwald's escape at the beginning of the second movie. One thing I see in favor of some variation on this theory is how easily Vogel seemed to forget and forgive the deaths of the people involved in the transfer of Grindelwald from the US to Europe when issuing the pardon. Easy enough to say there wasn't proof of the Muggle killings, etc., but I had wondered how and why Vogel could overlook the members of Wizarding law enforcement in that escape. But if Vogel himself was involved in some way, he would want to not remind people of the event. We don't know if back so many years ago Vogel had already been the head of the German Wizarding World or Supreme Mugwump, no idea of how long a term of office is involved.
That's true, because it's 4 years, right? So we don't know really how long any term of office is.
Is it not a job for life situation? Like, unless you get voted out, once you've got the job, it's pretty much yours?
It seems to be that way in England.
Yeah, because Fudge was definitely minister for more than 4 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we know nothing about the way other systems run.
Yeah,
and we won't get into it now, but they at one point specify in the series how long Fudge has actually been Minister of Magic, and that timeline for some reason doesn't add up to me, but we won't get into that now.
What? There are issues with timelines in the Harry Potter series?
Whoa.
I, for one, am shook at this revelation.
You know what? Fine. You twisted my arm. In order of the hey, I was going to let it go, and then you poked me. So
see
guess
what?
Here
Aaron.
We are now. In order of the Phoenix, they mention in an article in the Quibbler that Fudge rose to power as Minister of Magic 5 years previously, which means he's only been minister since just before the events of the first book. That doesn't track for me.
And why not?
Because of when Barty Crouch's son would have presumably died, and according to Sirius, he was shunted sideways into the Department of Magical Cooperation and Fudge got the top job. That makes it sound like he's had the job longer than 5 years. And unless you've got receipts to show otherwise, that's what I'm going with.
All right.
Minister.
But anyway, back to Jerry's comments about what we're actually here to discuss.
Yeah, this is interesting. I didn't really think about,
No, I know. It's true,
his
though.
His reaction of the deaths, right?
Was pretty cavalier about the fact that a lot of people died.
Yeah.
And with political leaders, that's one of those things that they all seem to handle differently. And sometimes I don't know if it's just how things are usually done in a particular part of the world, or if you come from a particular, social background, or if it's just dependent on the person. But there are some leaders who will give a speech where they're trying to keep things in perspective. And if the deaths of certain people, even if that number of deaths is especially high, and even if some of those deaths were government officials, they may still be determined to say, okay, yes, that was very bad, but we have to look at the bigger picture because there are people who are still alive now who are dealing with this thing and we need to resolve it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, would not be the first time somebody in power pardoned some very bad people who did kill people.
Wait, people do that for real?
What? Again, shocked.
When?
Shocked.
So, yeah. Vogel, I don't know, man. You messed up.
I thought he was gonna be a red herring when I first watched Secrets of Dumbledore. Like, you're supposed to spend the whole movie thinking, this dude looks like a Bond villain, and he's acting like one, and he's up to something. But then it turns out in the end, no, he was just this creepy guy who doesn't know how he comes across to people because he's not very self-aware. But then, nope, turns out he's actually shady.
Yep.
Yeah.
So they divert your expectations and then they divert them again. In a way, that's kind of clever.
This sketchy dude we're setting out to be a sketchy dude is a sketchy dude.
Yeah.
But you questioned yourself for a second.
But no, you were right.
He's sketchy.
He's a double red herring.
He is. thank you, Jerry, for sending in your owl. We love to hear about it. So if anyone else has theories about Vogel and thoughts about the Ministry of Magic and how often they hold elections, send them in. speakbeastie@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
If this becomes a thing and we actually end up talking about this on multiple episodes, I am going to laugh harder and harder the more it comes up.
It's going to be a thing. I can already guarantee you it's going to be a thing.
I'm inclined to agree with you.
We'll just have to keep track of how many episodes in our streak of talking about Vogel arranging for Grindelwald escape.
Yes. Yep.
We'll keep a tally.
We're up to two.
It has potential to become our longest running gag.
Just like with Duolingo, we have to keep the streak alive.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of keeping the streak alive, we are keeping this streak alive and talking about scenes 25 through 28 of the screenplay. We've officially arrived in Berlin in scene 25. We have the exterior of a train station, Berlin, evening. The description is literally frigid Berliners standing outside.
Now, is it the Berliners that are frigid, or is it Berlin itself that is frigid? Because
why
I would believe
both.
I would believe both. Not that people from Berlin are terrible, just that, you know, they sort of set up background characters in these movies. Have you ever noticed this? The background characters are, in a way, a perfect depiction of the mood of exactly what's going on. Like, things are cold, things are frigid, things are tense in Berlin right now. Mm-hmm. That's the action, and that's how the people look.
Yeah, and so I have been doing detective work on this movie to find out where in Berlin things are set, which is very difficult because a lot happened in, specifically in Berlin, no, I don't know, about 10 years after this movie happened. So not a lot of what would have been extant in Berlin in the 30s is still extant.
Like what?
Like most of it.
No, I mean, what happened in Berlin like 10 years later?
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic about not knowing about World War II.
No, I mean,
this is Jeff you're dealing with.
I just, the way that you went, when I said that, that's what I wanted.
So your
research on where exactly these things are going down, like exactly how much train Googling have you done?
Okay, so I was over at my friend's place last night to research this. Like, not to research it, I was over at her place and I was researching it. We were watching the Wednesday night AEW wrestling event while I was over there. I was serious, and which is a two-hour thing, right? I was Googling trains and translating things from Cyrillic for a solid 45 minutes. Because here's what I found out. My best guess for the train that the Wizarding Express is attached to is the Nord Express, which ran from Paris to Berlin to Moscow during this time period. It stopped at the Ostbahnhof, the Friedrichstrasse station, and then the Zoological Garden station. Best guess is that they get off at the Friedrichstrasse station just because, based on what the area looks like and all of that, it has kind of like that central Berlin kind of vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to find out what station it stopped at, because Berlin has multiple international train stations and did at the time as well. And the only timetable I could find was in Cyrillic.
What?
So I go to Google Translate. I type in Berlin in English and translate it to Russian so I can see what it looks like. And then I find what the matching Cyrillic letters on the timetable. And then I start typing in painstakingly each station so I can, and then I have to start Googling, okay, what was this train station called in 1914 and what is it called now?
So, Anne, you were concerned about me and Jeff. I think I can speak for both of us that we're now concerned for you. You okay?
I just want to know where things are set. I just want to know where things are.
Geography is your love language. I get it.
Oh, I just like knowing where, because then you can go visit it and you can be like, hey, this is the train station that all my friends Newton Theseus got off at.
Right, because you're going to go to Germany and do that.
I did go to Germany.
She just did.
I did do that.
I can't. This episode is like so chaotic right now.
I thought you were doing this a week ago.
What's happening?
Oh my gosh. Okay. I think we need to just move into the next scene.
Speaking of trains.
There's so many trains.
We're going into the train in scene 26. Oh. Interior. Magical train carriage. Evening. Newt is very cute with the Chilin. Feeding it. Telling it's a good girl. Give it a treat.
He calls it little one, and I'm like, oh. I call my youngest cat that when I pick them up, because they're very Molly is very dense, which is why I also call her pound cake sometimes.
Oh, no!
But she's very small, and she's not even, like, heavy. Like, she does not look like an overweight cat. She looks like a perfectly normal cat. She's just incredibly dense, but she's the youngest out of all of them. So I call her little one sometimes when I pick her up, and I'm like, oh, and it reminds me of me and my cat. He cares so much. It's just so wonderful that it's a shame he can't relate more to other people, because I feel like that bothers him sometimes that he can't just do that. But it's so touching to always see him interacting with the animals.
Yeah.
Imagine him talking to people like he talks to the animals, though. That'd be really funny.
Oh, he's just like picking up Queenie. Okay, little one.
You're a good little one.
Isn't that what Vinda said to Queenie when she met her on the street?
Pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah.
That sounds right. I love Lally's sass, because yes. I feel like Lally's line is all of us a moment ago when we're talking about Berlin. She just says, Berlin, wonderful.
Berlin in the winter, too. Like, that's pretty brutal.
She looks thrilled to be there.
Maybe she just doesn't, like, I personally would enjoy it because I like the cold, but maybe she is one of those people who just does not like the cold.
Yeah, maybe. And my experience, we were in Munich in February, my God, that was like 15 years ago. Oh my God. Anyway, but it was cold. Like it wasn't as cold as it gets here in Chicago, but it like was windy and the wind just cut through you, I remember. So maybe it just doesn't like wind.
Yeah, I can relate. I don't like wind either.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate wind. I love cold, but I hate wind. I can guard myself against cold, I can deal with hot, but wind, you cannot deal, you can't do anything about it. You just have to sit there and let it happen to you.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So train stops, comma, bounces, he and Theseus have a moment, they lock eyes.
You just ship Theseus with everyone, don't you, sweetie?
Especially me, yes.
Yes, I know he's your husband, but you just, I mean, that's a very BL manga thing to do. Like, you want somebody, but yet also you ship them with every other fictional character that you love, and it's fine. It's a healthy thing. People do it.
Oh, just you wait. I have not yet begun to ship Theseus with everyone.
Yes. That is such a promising statement.
It will happen.
Just they're not the only ones, because Bunty shoots her shot. And you know what? Good-o, Bunty. You go for it, girl. It's not going to work out, and you know it, but you're going for it.
Yeah, like, she takes his hand and says, no one can know everything, not even you. Which
that is a nothing statement.
Is also really weird, because when I think of people who need to know what's going on, the last person I think of, it's Newt's commander. Like, I feel like he would be much happier if brain empty only animals, you know? Like, he doesn't he doesn't want to be involved in this. Why does he need to know anything?
Yeah.
No.
I was thinking that this might be referring to how Newt might think he's the only person that Dumbledore is talking to about the plans in this situation. Because if we look back at the last film, it was always Newt and Dumbledore meeting to talk about Grindelwald, you know, on the roof, in the bus. And Dumbledore doesn't really talk to anyone else about it in the previous film. But now he's even sent a note to Bunty, which is an interesting choice.
And again, I really need to rewatch. I just didn't have time to do it this week, but it just says, as she goes, Newt clocks Theseus and Jacob watching him. And it's just so funny because you're like, Theseus and Jake were like, oh, we are new Tina shippers, but maybe we are getting aboard on the good ship Nunty, which is a horrible ship name.
It's a terrible ship name. I don't care for it at all. It sounds like you're trying not to say something inappropriate.
Which is where I wrote my ship name for them in the dock. Boot. Like, boot.
Oh, that's cute.
That's clever. Or you could put Newt in the middle of Bunty and have it booty.
Oh!
Yes! Yes! Yes!
Yes!
I have done good here today. Actually, the good that I've done here today is I know that we all, the looks that the characters give each other, like you notice them in the movie and you might even remember them, but you don't think this hard about how the characters are looking at each other until you read the description of the scene. And it led me to this thought, which I put in underlines because when I wrote this, it became one of those things where I won't lie, I was pleased with this thought that I came up with. I said, when you watch the movie, what you notice comes naturally. When you read the screenplay, you notice what the text tells you to notice.
That is very true.
Yeah.
It doesn't just draw your attention to it. Like, it puts it specifically into context for you. Like, it's almost like they're trying to make sure that you notice what they want you to, and you think about it the way that they want you to.
Yeah. And it just shows that it works, right? Like, if you...
Sure it does.
There's very intentional directions in screenplays, and then to see it come across so beautifully on film, like, I feel like we picked up on all of these little looks and things before we read the screenplay, so they did their job for sure.
Yeah, we just didn't think about them to this extent.
And that's why I think I've, I don't know if it was the last episode or another one that we did recently, but I wondered about how much of what we're reading here is the script that the actors also got, and how much of it is just a transcription of what ended up being in the film. Because that kind of makes me think, are the actors also reading these descriptions of the things that the text wants them to focus on and just thinks, no, that doesn't feel right to me. I'm going to do it the way I want to do it. And then the actor's instinct turns out to be right, but that's still not what's in the script.
Yeah, it's probably a combination of a lot of things.
I mean, you got a really solid cast of very talented actors here, so yeah. I would hope at least that the people who are making this movie would trust the actors to just do what comes naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I know a lot of actors have described how much they enjoy working with David Yates as a director, and unless I'm confusing him with someone else again, I think that's one of the things that people have said about David Yates is that he has faith in his actors.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. It's nice to hear because there are a lot of he's not a puppet master director. He's not trying to force your every finger twitch.
Mm-hmm. Well, considering the caliber of actors he was working with when he took on the Potter films by that point, I mean, you had Alan Rickman and you had Maggie Smith, and then you had Imelda Staunton on his first turn as a Potter director. I wouldn't really fancy giving them too many specific directions and mad at them if they don't follow them. I wouldn't want Alan Rickman mad at me. Seems like a nice guy, but I wouldn't want to make him mad.
No. And we are heading out now. We are in scene 27, exterior street, Berlin. Moments later, night. It is snowing. Jacob, Newt, Lally, and Theseus are moving through the streets and heading into an entrance for the German Ministry of Magic. Not really clear if there's just one entrance. That's probably somewhere in central Berlin. Or there are many entrances. I don't know. We don't know. Who knows?
Anybody else watch this moment and think about the first time they watched that scene where Hagrid taps the bricks and then they just kind of move aside and that's the entrance to Diagon Alley because that's how it works?
Oh, definitely.
But then you have this, which, you know, chronologically takes place decades before, but presumably Diagon Alley is still in the same place doing its thing. That's still how you get in there. But here... It's like they're designing the scene, they're figuring out how it works, and they're thinking, okay, we have better technology and a lot more money than we had when we made the first movie in this universe, so how can we step it up from there instead of just keeping it the way it was? Part of me would have preferred it if the bricks had just moved aside and we'd done it the same way, but why? What is it with this thing about apparating between places?
I don't think they operate between anywhere. I feel like it makes sense for Germany that they wouldn't necessarily want to faff around with having, oh, look, our bricks are folding back. They were just like, no, we walk through to get to work. We don't have time for that. We just go. We're not quirky. We're just going.
So don't put it out there where so many people can see it. Put it somewhere else.
It strikes me as a very, like, platform 9 3/4. Like, you can walk through it.
Yeah, don't get me started on that. I love platform 9 3/4. I love the Hogwarts Express, but don't get me started on how ridiculous it is that wizards are just running through this wall between platforms and they count on the obliviousness of the everyday muggle to just not notice that this is happening.
I mean, to be fair, I'm sure that got a lot easier for them post the iPhone, because now really nobody, you could run full tilt through King's Cross and people are, no one's gonna notice.
Agreed, but it's wizards don't adapt well. They don't update things. They just keep them the way they are. They come up with new spells for things, but the closest to embracing technology that wizards ever get is when they installed toilets at Hogwarts, and that's where it stopped.
True.
Anyway, back to Germany.
Anywho.
This might be jumping ahead in the screenplay a little bit, but it's still within the same scene. I have questions. First of all, Anton Vogel in the screenplay is described as benign looking. With that collar and that coat, honey, no. No. That dude is not been, he himself, like, his face might be kind of benign looking. Maybe that's what they meant. I don't know. But you have, like, his face is benign looking. You have to put it that way, because in that coat, no. No. That's a coat that, that's a no, don't notice me pose coat.
Yeah, maybe it is just because he's kind of bland looking, except for the coat, yeah. I guess.
Maybe that's it. Maybe, like, that's the, like, the way he dresses is his way of reminding people, by the way, I'm a wizard. Wizards are occasionally extravagant oddballs, but I myself am about as exciting as a biscuit that has been sitting on the table awaiting for the tea ceremony for several days.
Delicious.
And speaking of tea ceremonies, do Germans have, this tea ceremony thing confuses me somewhat. Is it because they're in Germany? Is it because they're wizards? Like, I looked up tea ceremonies to kind of find out. Most of the information I was able to find on tea ceremonies comes from traditions in places like Japan and China and other countries that are in Asia, but I couldn't find anything to support that Germans have tea ceremonies.
Yeah, I found that kind of odd too, because Newt says something like, oh, we have a tea ceremony to get to or something like that.
Yeah.
I was like, huh, what? But, like, later in scenes we see kind of what's happening. It just kind of looks like they're having tea, like there's teapots pouring tea, and there's, like,
more like maybe a posh person thing, because everybody here is, like, rich and, well, probably rich and, like, politicians, so it's more like a hobnobby thing, more like maybe not a cocktail party, but instead a tea party.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought, too.
I guess that makes sense. Like, it's a political event, but they're not raising funds. It's a very official thing, but they don't really know what else to call it. But tea is being served at this event, so you call it a tea ceremony, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since there are actual tea ceremonies that have a very important and very specific purpose and function, is that just, like, a kind of a slip of the tongue, or could you actually consider that a misappropriation?
I don't know. I thought it was kind of just an odd wording. I was like, oh, that's weird. I don't really understand that, but I don't know.
So not a misappropriation then, since it's not intentionally taking that and misusing it?
I wouldn't think so. I guess I would think it was more a misappropriation if we saw a tea ceremony in Germany and they were trying to do some weird version of the other tea ceremonies, that's when I would maybe think, oh, that seems like appropriation. But I think it was just, like, a weird naming.
Yeah,
I
think maybe it's more of, like, a ceremony that involves tea, as you said. Like, so it's the best name for it is a tea ceremony, despite not being what we would traditionally think of as a tea ceremony. But you can't call it a ceremony with tea, because that also sounds weird.
Yeah. Okay, I see what you mean.
So, going back to my rage about locations.
More trains!
Give us more geographical passion.
So, It makes sense that the ministry would be in central Berlin, which because that's where the Reichstag, Bundestag, the main government building of Germany is. And we know that the Ministry of Magic in the UK is located in London. I don't think it's near 10 Downing Street or anything, but we know that it's at least in central London. And the French magical government, I don't really think we have a clear idea where in Paris it is, but it is at least located in Paris. So it does seem that most magical governments are going to be located in the capital city of that country, except for the U.S., because I guess they were just like, no, we really want to be by Fifth Avenue.
Which I have an answer for that, because I'm that history nerd, just like you're that train nerd.
I'm not a train person. I don't want that to be my thing.
Well, then
you shouldn't have got so hung up on trains, Anne.
I'm going to send you all sorts of train stuff this Christmas. It's going to be great. Anyway, so the whole MACUSA positioning thing actually sort of makes sense because the U.S. Capitol was originally in New York City before it got moved to Washington, D.C. And George Washington was actually sworn in on the steps of Federal Hall in New York City, which is a 9-minute walk from the Woolworth Building, according to Google Maps, and the Woolworth Building is MACUSA. So it looks like wizards in the U.S. could have positioned their government building near where the Capitol was at the time, and then it got moved, and they're like, nah, we're good. We like our building here.
I mean, we've already put all these enchantments in place. At the time, D.C. was just a swamp, so... If you've got some nice, I've got a nice building going in New York, you know what, I'm in a swamp.
Yeah.
And so this is the only, like, part of Wizarding Germany that we really see, and it seems to just be the ministry. Do you think that there's, like, a German equivalent to Diagon Alley?
I mean, there has to be. There's obviously, there is a wizarding world. I think that sometimes, without realizing it, some people might just consider that the wizarding world is kind of like the multiverse in Marvel, where it's just every universe exists at the same time and it's its whole separate thing. Like, there's an alternate version of the world we live in, and that's where all the Wizarding World stuff is, but it's every country has these, you know, a Wizarding World and the Muggle world, or whatever you want to call it, and they live side by side without the Muggles knowing it. So there has to be all this other stuff for not just in the United States where we've been, in France, in Germany, in all these other countries. They have to have shops and houses. Yeah. Obviously, they have schools. So, sure, they might not call it Diagon Alley, but there's got to be a place like that in Germany.
Sure.
Yeah.
What would you call it?
I feel like I have a name in my head, but I can't remember if that is something I read in a fanfic or if it's an actual thing. Hang on, I'm going to Google it to make sure I'm not...
We could put it out to the listeners. What would you... If Diagon Alley was in Germany, what would you call it? It would have to be, like, one word that has 19 syllables in it that translates into, like, 10 different words that is, like, a fully formed sentence. Don't at me. I understand how complicated the German language can be sometimes. It's a beautiful language, but the grammatical rules of the German language just give me indigestion sometimes.
So what I was thinking of is Kastanialli, which is in Prenzlauer Berg, and it's a trendy little shopping center area. So maybe that would be... I think the reason I got it kind of stuck in my head as, like, a magical thing is because it's got the word cast in it, like, casting spells. And it was a very neat little area. It had this cool shop, so it did feel a little bit magical, except for the fact that it was pouring. So that's what I kind of had in my head, because it was, like, a narrow little alley, and it was... You kind of had to duck into it. But, yeah, no, I'd love to hear what people think is the German equivalent of Diagon Alley. And so we move into a quote from Eddie Redmayne. He says, quote, "One of the things that I always loved about the Potter films and the whole wizarding world is the idea that we live in our own world, and right next door to us, brushing our shoulder through that wall, another more fantastical, more thrilling world exists. Getting to see that in other countries rather than just in London and Britain has been astonishing.
So there you go, the multiverse.
Yep.
Exactly. And he's talking about how, you know, exactly how he says, they're brushing shoulders with each other. It's not like you have to get Doctor Strange to transport you from one dimension to the next in order to go to Diagon Alley. It's right there. You just can't see it.
And I think that is really part of my frustration with this, is that it is supposed to be shoulder to shoulder with our world, but they're not giving us specific, or even an idea of a specific location, so that, which would make it feel more real. Like, you can't just say, oh, it's, at least for me, when I'm like working on something, I don't just say, oh, this is set somewhere in Chicago. I'm going to give you a specific neighborhood. I'm going to give you something to make it feel more real, feel more grounded.
Well, that's true. But at the same time, if they don't, the less specifics they give you, the more room there is for headcanon. Because the reason that some authors don't answer specific questions about their own universe isn't because they don't have an answer. It's because other people have different answers that make sense to them and they don't want to take that away.
That's true.
Because once they answer a question, it becomes fixed, and then all the headcanons that contradict that suddenly become invalid, and it often leads to like 100 more questions that the author shouldn't have to answer.
That is true.
Don't make them do all the work. They built this world, and maybe it's a little broken, but good luck building a literary world that isn't a little bit broken. Just do some of the lifting, okay? Just enjoy it. It's fun. It's a book. In this case, it's a movie, but you get it.
The next piece of behind-the-scenes stuff we get is the German Ministry of Magic insignia, which is gorgeous.
Absolutely sharp. I love it.
And they talk about it a little bit in the movie Magic Book, how the eagle is kind of imperial-looking and how they really leaned hard into the Art Deco vibe for the German ministry, because that was a very big thing in Germany, was that whole Art Deco straight lines, very aerodynamic and structured kind of look.
Thank you for defining Art Deco, because that the term keeps coming up and I keep not knowing what it means and I keep forgetting to Google it, so thanks.
You are welcome. I went on a... When we were on the Magic back in 2019, we did a tour of the ship and they talked about Art Nouveau versus Art Deco. So that just stuck in my head for forever. And there is zero merch with this logo on it. And I need a pin or a keychain. I don't really buy official merch anymore, but I would probably want to buy this really badly and then not buy it.
So I got this great keychain when I was in Orlando last week, and it's got little like charms, individual charms dangling from a chain of the different beasts. It would be so cool to have one like that with the different logos of the ministry.
Yes! Oh my god, that'd be so rad.
Okay, Etsy shop owners of the world, unite and make unofficial merchandise of this stuff, because if you do it right, they can't sue you and we can still have the merchandise. Find the loopholes.
We also have...
I love enamel pins.
Oh yes, I love a good enamel pin or a keychain or something. Just give it to me. We also have some German wizarding currency. It is ein Eisenkeiler, which translates to an iron boar. So I guess that is their currency, is the Eisenkeiler, or at least one of their forms of currency.
Cool. I like it.
And the boar, in my head, it looked a lot more like the respect the spell limit sign at Hogsmeade. But when I actually like looked it up and I linked it in the show, I linked it here. It mostly the similarities that they're both boars. But I don't know, maybe it's a magical thing. And apparently we also learned from the coins that the German equivalent of Gringotts is Sperlingsbank. So nothing really about that. When I googled it trying to see if there's any more information, I literally could only find a French Harry Potter wiki. That's it. And just I would love some insight from Mina Lima as to like the symbolism. What were the leaves? What are the flowers? Why did they pick them? Why are there seven stars on the boar? Just more information.
Yeah.
I would love to know that too, but at the same time, I feel like as artists and as high profile artists with a very lucrative and very successful graphic design business, they are constantly being asked why about every single detail, and sometimes it might just be because we thought it looked nice.
That's fine. Then I can make up my headcanons about it.
You know what? I would rather hear, rather than Mina Lima explaining why the leaves, why the flowers, I would rather hear Anne hypothesize wildly on very little sleep about why.
All right. I know what my Patreon content for November is. I see how it is.
Fantastic.
I was trying to find out what the stars might mean, because I was like, oh, maybe that's one that, like, actually has a meaning and we can look at. The only thing I could find about stars in Germany and a certain number of stars was on soccer uniforms. And I think four stars symbolizes four World Cup wins or something like that.
Okay.
I don't know soccer, so if that's wrong, I'm sorry. But that was my quick glance through Google. When I was looking at Germany and seven stars, the only thing that came up was four stars and soccer.
Well, so I was thinking about, because the Chicago flag has stars on it, and I thought that maybe the number of stars in the placement was symbolic, because on the Chicago flag, the four stars are four major events in Chicago history. So I thought, well, maybe that's something similar. Maybe not. Maybe it is just pretty and seven is a lucky number in magic. We really don't know.
I have a question that I'm not going to ask because we're going to go all day about it. I'm just going to ask it off.
Okay.
Somebody remind me that I have a question that I'm going to ask later.
Okay. So the last bit of extra that we have for this scene is an entrance sketch of the German Ministry of Magic. So we've got the eagle in the brickwork along with the MM and... There's a person, so we can kind of get an idea for the scale. Maybe it's Dumbledore. He's wearing a hat and a jacket like Dumbledore does. And there's wanted posters of Grindelwald. And it's kind of funny because the way the scene ends is as Jacob hurries off, he passes a moving wanted poster of Grindelwald, staring out, following Jacob's every move. Jacob can't help but warily hold Grindelwald's gaze. So...
It's probably
sus.
Nothing.
Sus.
It's fine.
I still just find it really odd how this all plays out. Like, there's wanted posters hanging up, but then, like, Vogel's just like, nah, it's all good. We don't need to catch him.
Let's just let him run
for president. And then it's like, I don't know. It's just very odd. What's the point of hanging up these wanted posters if you're just going to be like, he's fine.
Yeah.
I doubt he notices the wanted posters. I feel like he doesn't. He didn't. Somebody else in his ministry okayed the posters, designed the posters, put up the posters. Like, he's probably mildly aware that there are wanted posters up for him. But also, wanted posters... Really? I mean, I know that wizards aren't exactly up on technology, but wanted posters?
Pretty sure everyone knows that you're looking for Grindelwald.
Are we in the Wild West? Look, I'm sorry, but we are not in the Wild West. People don't... No. If an owl can bring you a newspaper, or you can listen to the Wizarding Wireless and there's news reports from the government going out, no, you don't need wanted posters.
Well, they're still doing it in the 90s. They've got Sirius Black's poster out there.
And it doesn't make sense then either. They just wanted to design a wanted poster that moves so you can look at it and say, oh, look, another piece of paper with a moving picture on it.
Oh, look at that. Gary Oldman's up to something. He sure is yelling.
Gary, even when he was haggard and dirty looking, Gary Oldman made Sirius Black look handsome.
Mm-hmm.
I love the lack of disagreeing with me on that. I mean, thank you.
I don't know how you would disagree with that.
Yeah, Gary Oldman's a good looking guy.
Gary Oldman's not your type, or you're super turned off by bad teeth. Not that Gary Oldman has bad teeth, but they gave him bad teeth in that scene because it makes sense.
Yeah.
It just fits. Anyway, back to the German Ministry of
so
Magic.
So, speaking of no one's teeth, that's a bad segue. Scene 28, exterior, steps, German Ministry, moments later, night. And we've got contingents of Lou and Santos supporters chanting and hoisting banners, quote, in the air in an exuberant but peaceful display of partisan passion. And I, again, need to rewatch, but if I remember, like, it doesn't feel particularly exuberant. it feels like everyone's tense. Like it feels like everyone's just waiting for the keg, the powder keg, to explode. Like it does.
It's
no
menacing.
One's particularly seems to be having a good time.
Yeah,
I feel like exuberance. Just looking up a technical definition, filled with or characterized by a lively energy and excitement. So I would characterize it that way. I was checking because I wanted to see if exuberance implies something positive or if exuberance can be negative, which I suppose it can. So I feel like exuberance is right, but peaceful doesn't feel right at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What I wrote in my notes is tea ceremony my tuchus. This is a political event and all political events are tense.
Truth.
There are no peaceful political events.
I guess, like, peaceful, if you're going by, has something violent happened in the crowd, right? So it's peaceful in terms of, are they just standing there exercising their right to yell about what candidate they want? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess it would be peaceful. They're not doing anything other than yelling and holding banners.
Yeah, in terms of respecting the peace by not doing anything unlawful, sure.
Yeah.
But again, are we going to think that hard about it? No.
Is it peaceful as in sleepy? No.
No.
No. Like, are they tranquil and docile? No. This is an election.
And we also had some really good stuff in, like, behind-the-scenes stuff in this one. We actually have an image of the wanted poster that they use with space left for moving photographs of Grindelwald. And again, I am translating this because Google Translate was my best friend last night. And it translates to, have you seen this wizard? Wanted for serious and brutal crimes against the magical world. And part of this might be Google Translate because it doesn't always translate things like humans would. And because this next sentence is very funny, this powerful magician has a magic wand and is extremely dangerous.
You know, that's surprisingly valid because you might actually wonder if somebody's on the run from the law, if they have a wand or not, because people assume Sirius Black didn't have a wand, but the reports about Sirius Black did specify that he has, this is one of my favorite descriptions of a thing ever, a gun, which is a type of metal wand that Muggles use for killing each other. A type of metal wand. Oh, brother.
Also, according to the poster, the word for magic wand in German is Zauberstab. Which
you know
I
what?
Love.
Just because I
love
that this
is great.
Just, I'm going to pronounce it just because I love that in the German language, the Z has the TS sound. It's Zauberstab.
Ah, perfect. It's beautiful. Yes. I love it.
Love it.
So there's a reward for 5,000 dragets, which is weird because isn't that American currency?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I looked it up and just to make sure, because I was pretty sure that the dude, the 12 trees guy that got the whole mess with Nomad just started, was the keeper of something something in Dragots, and he is. So Dragots are American currency.
Is this because he escaped from Makuza? So is
maybe
the reward to be paid to the American wizarding government?
Well, it says if you continue, it says, should he be cited, he must be immobilized and arrested without delay. The ICW of Department of the Aurors must be informed immediately by Owl. Anyone with any information about this wizard or his whereabouts should contact the International Magical Police immediately. So it's the ICW that is sponsoring this.
I'm sorry. If he should be cited, he must be immobilized and arrested without delay. Surely they aren't expecting average everyday citizens to attempt to engage with
citizens
a dangerous
arrest.
Dark wizard.
No, they 100%
no.
are because wizards
no.
are dumb.
Absolutely not. I don't care if you suck at establishing governments. I don't care if you suck at banks and education and, you know, forming an entire society. I don't care how much you suck at those things. You don't encourage average everyday people to engage with dangerous wanted criminals. You encourage the opposite. You specify don't engage, contact the authorities. You don't tell people to do that. That is so gross. I feel gross now. I need a shower now. Filth.
We move on to a German Ministry of Magic exterior location rendering. And it looks like a government building. Y'all know what it looks like. You've seen the movie, presumably, at this point. Mm-hmm. And there are statues in front. And I did not remember the backstory on the statues, but Jeff says it looks like you found some.
Yeah. Now, in this rendering, there are, I count, 8 statues here. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this is even necessarily the statues that this quote is referring to, but this is a paragraph from the Secrets of Dumbledore movie magic book titled Heroic Decoration. It says, the 4 statues in the German Ministry of Magic were created by sculptor Julian Murray. These were inspired by the German heroic legends of Siegfried, Wotan, which is Odin, Parsifal, and the Valkyrie Brunhilde, who were immortalized in operas by German composer Richard Wagner. They've been finished as bronzes, says Neil Lamont, and they've given a verdigris patina, to complement the blue-hued brick of the exterior facade. So actually, maybe this is that? I'm not sure.
So maybe they just have multiples?
Well, I mean, that would make sense because, I mean, these are, these legends are from, it mentions immortalized in operas by Richard Wagner. Wotan, at least, Siegfried and Brunhilde, those are characters from Wagner's Ring Cycle, which is a set of 4 operas. Those tell the stories of the gods from Norse mythology. Parsifal is its whole separate thing, but these are all very, very popular German legends. So it would make sense to me that these legends would still have immortalization in statue form. Mm-hmm. It's curious to me because that implies that in Germany, magical and non-magical people have the same legends, whereas they've gone to great trouble to establish that in the Muggle world in Britain, magical people and non-magical people have different fairy tales and legends. Ron thinks Cinderella is an illness for crying out loud. And Hermione, as an opposite, has never heard of the tales of Beedle the Bard until Dumbledore leaves her a copy. But here we see an example of how magical and non-magical people in Germany have the same stories.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if the difference is like Beedle the Bard and fairy tales are more considered like folklore, where things like Nicholas Flamel and stuff like that would be considered like history.
I'm sorry, I'm talking about myths and legends and stories. What does Nicholas Flamel have to do with any of that?
Right, but like there's different things where it is like they both Muggles and wizards have the same story rooted in something, okay. But it's like the different truths of what that actually is and looks
like. Okay, I apologize. No, I'm with you now.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
No, that does make good sense. I forgot that even Muggles seem aware of what alchemy is and who Nicholas Flamel was, even though they don't believe that a philosopher's stone is a real thing that exists. They don't know that somebody actually made one. But no, I see
so
your point.
I wonder if that's like what this is like with like Odin and stuff like that. If it's that sort of deal where like it's sort of like the same story in a way, but somewhat different for the Muggles and wizards.
We could go all day with this. The fact that this is these are the legends that they're embracing because those are, I mean, Parsifal and he led a mission to try to discover the spear that supposedly was used to pierce the side of Jesus Christ during the crucifixion. That's what Parsifal is. Mm-hmm. And then the others are from Norse mythology. And I'm not sure if those legends would really be as relevant in Germany as they would be if not for the musical dramas that Richard Wagner turned them into.
Hmm.
So I think I could be incorrect, and someone please correct me if I am, but I think it's actually Wagner's doing that those characters are so important in German history.
Hmm.
Because as much as he was an outspoken anti-Semite, and he was, Richard Wagner is not one of Germany's most famous composers for no reason.
Right.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Moving on to other people who are famous. Theseus is famous.
Is he? I forget.
He is famous and cute. Yeah, hang on. I'm going to flip to that. The aura blocking... So Theseus and... So the squad is going up the stairs. And a German aura tries to stop Lally and Jacob. And Theseus says, "Evening, Helmut." Helmut says, "Theseus." Theseus says, "Hey there with me." The aura blocking them sees Theseus and his eyes flicker with recognition. He glances to the commanding aura, Helmut, overseeing all at the top of the stairs, who nods. So... like, they know him. They know that this guy is the head auror, or at least they're familiar enough with him that they know that he's somebody in authority.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because we know that he's famous as a war hero, right? But mm-hmm.
That's true.
Germans would have been on the opposite side of the war of him. So it's interesting that he's, like, notorious on both sides.
Yeah.
You know, I really hadn't thought about that very much until you said that just now about, I mean, I really didn't think that much about magical people fighting in the Great War until Fantastic Beasts brought it up. But now I'm wondering, did magical peoples in different countries have to fight against each other in the war because the war was going on?
Right. Like, how did that work? If you were a wizard in Germany, would you automatically side with Germany as a country, or would you give your allegiance somewhere else? Like, how does that work?
Or much like in the non-magical world, can different countries take different stances, even of neutrality, based on their individual principles? Maybe mm-hmm, the right. German, you know, maybe the Germans were against certain countries during the Great War, but maybe the German magical community said, listen, they're the ones having this fight, but we don't necessarily have the same issues with the same country's magical mm-hmm. community. Maybe mm-hmm. we should just stay out of it.
Yeah. Well, and as a whole, wizards were supposed to stay out of it.
Yeah, that's always the impression that I got in the books was that they didn't really get involved in that kind of thing. And then we find out that they do get involved, like super involved.
Really do.
Yeah.
Finally, speaking of my significant others, Rosier and Caro show up and Vinda just wants to watch the world burn, just setting literally. Stuff on fire, acting as agent of chaos, which like... her role in this, like this scene and later scenes, where she just shows up looking serene and ethereal and just like waves a hand and stuff just blows up. Just iconic and chaotic. We stand a chaotic queen.
Yeah, she manages to look more exuberant and peaceful, like the script says, and yet she is there to deliberately cause the most chaos.
Yep.
She's so casual about it. It's so great.
She's just there to give those eyebrow looks to the camera in her perfect makeup.
Mm. And we love it for it. We love her for it. We love her for
it. Love it.
And that wraps up our exploration of the screenplay for this week. So, yeah, that a lot happened in just a few scenes.
It's amazing how much we can really get out of these by going through what's in the screenplay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So speaking of going through things, it's spook beastie. We've talked about that, which means it's Halloween season for people who live in places where they do that kind of thing. So we're going to do a special time turner today about one of my favorite things about Halloween, which is trick-or-treating.
A few times should do it, love.
I trick-or-treated a lot, and I loved it. And so I thought today we could talk a little bit about where trick-or-treating specifically came from. This isn't a comprehensive history of Halloween and everything to do with it. This is specifically a little bit of where the tradition of trick-or-treating came from. And like everything else, it starts hundreds of years ago with Christianity, because doesn't everything... So picture it. It's the 9th century and Christianity is spreading because that's what Christianity does, especially in the earlier centuries. So it spreads into the Celtic lands, and round about November 2nd in the year 1000 AD, they declare November 2nd is All Souls Day. And celebrations of that in England resemble a holiday known as Samhain, I think it's pronounced.
I think it's Samhain.
Is it?
Yeah. I've heard others say Samhain.
Okay. Because, you know, Celtic, nothing is actually pronounced how you would think. Yeah.
Well, we've established I'm not great at pronunciation, so if you say something is pronounced any kind of way, I'm inclined to believe you. So the celebrations in England resemble that and are complete with bonfires, masquerades, and something called souling. I thought this was fun. Souling is the practice of promising to pray for the souls of a person's dead relatives in exchange for pastries, otherwise known as soul cakes. Eventually, the practice grew to include other foods and ale. So you go to somebody's house and you offer to pray for the homeowner's relatives in exchange for sustenance. Like everybody who walks up to somebody's door and asks for a cake has some kind of spiritual link to whatever.
I love that.
Yes, it's a pretty great system.
I'm gonna pray for your grandmother. Give me a beer.
Yeah, short step from that kind of thing to the, I forget what they call it. It was one of the things that Martin Luther banned when he established Lutheranism, but I think it was the selling of...
plenary indulgences?
Yeah, that, where you pay the church in exchange for being absolved of your transgressions. Yeah, short step from that to that. Anyhow, so these traditions then started to spread to other parts of the world, like in Scotland and Ireland, where they grew to include something they call guising, which is dressing up in costume and accepting various offerings from households in exchange for singing a song, reciting a poem, telling a joke, or performing a trick. Typical treats for that kind of thing would include things like fruits, nuts, or coins. So this kind of feels like the secular version of souling. Instead of offering to pray for people, you give them, it's basically, this is performance art, it feels like. You sing a song, you do a poem, you tell a joke, and in exchange people give you, again, they're giving you things to eat and drink, or they're giving you money. So this is where we start to see they hand out things other than just pastries, but at this point nobody's handing out candy. I don't know if candy's been invented yet. Don't worry, candy will become a very big part of this, but we're going to fast forward a little bit to the 17th century for something that just sounds like tons of fun. For an activity called Guy Fawkes Night, or Bonfire Night. So this is a holiday that was meant to commemorate the foiling of what's known as the Gunpowder Plot, which, as I understand it, it refers to when Guy Fawkes led a conspiracy to blow up England's Parliament building and remove King James I from power because he was a Protestant.
Tisk.
Yes, it did not work. And Guy Fawkes was put to death for it. And in celebration, every year they would build bonfires, also called bonfires. And they were built to burn effigies and the symbolic bones of the Catholic Pope. And children are, this is the best part of this, children are roaming the streets with effigies that are hopefully not on fire yet, asking for pennies. So we went from people offering up prayers in exchange for pastries. We then went to people, you know, singing and dancing in exchange for fruit and nuts and pennies. Now we've got children specifically who are carrying effigies through the street begging for money, and then they burn them to commemorate a guy who failed to commit an act of domestic terrorism. I know what you're thinking. When are we going to get to the candy?
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the introduction of the best Halloween candy, candy corn.
I'm so glad that you asked, because I am not going to talk about candy corn specifically at all.
That will be next week.
If you wanted a time turner on candy corn, you should have asked. But you know what? We're going to get to candy, though, because now we're going to jump up to the 20th century, where we have the Great Depression, it happened, and something that became known as Devil's Night or Mischief Night. Because as Europeans and people from other parts of the world started to immigrate to the colonies, which became the United States of America. They bring all these traditions and practices with them. And then the Great Depression happened. And food and money were incredibly scarce, so unfortunately, people didn't have anything to give out to the children, and the children had all this pent-up adolescent energy, and they were mad that they couldn't get pastries in exchange for their prayers, so they decided to focus more on pranks, acts of vandalism, and even violence.
Yikes.
Very, very safe. So a lot of communities would get together and they would organize trick-or-treating events to give the children something because they wanted to keep their homes from being vandalized and they wanted to keep themselves from getting beat up by gangs of children who clearly just need sugar.
This is what happens when you give kids effigies to burn and it's then, true. You know, it just messes them up.
That had the cadence of a joke, and yet I agree with you. Do not give effigies to children. That's a bad idea. So just as things are starting to settle back down again, not really, World War II happens. And this led to many terrible things, but it also led to rationing of sugar. So candy and sweets were pretty scarce for a while, so they couldn't really do that then either. But then, once the war was over, things started to kind of get back to, I guess, what they would call normal, and sugar was a little bit more abundant. A lot of candy companies, some of them probably made candy corn. The invention of candy corn probably came up at some point in this timeline, but candy companies saw an opportunity to revive a lot of these practices by launching national advertising campaigns that were specifically aimed at Halloween, because they decided this is not exactly an untapped market, but it was something that they could kind of turn to their advantage. So they make the candy available, they make it seem like there's this one day of the year when you get a whole bunch of it, and that's how trick-or-treating as we know it really became a big thing. And that's why the focus is mainly on candy. Some people don't want to give out candy, so they try to give out things a little bit healthier. You might find some people who try to make a history argument and say it's more traditional to give out, you know, bread or fruit or nuts or whatever. I remember when I was a kid, there were all these cartoons and all these TV shows that would show kids trick-or-treating and getting mad because they got fruit or they got healthy snacks instead of candy, and the kids would revolt. But I remember thinking, oh, cool, food, snacks, yay. I didn't care if it was candy or not.
Yeah.
And then today, Americans, according to the National Retail Federation, Americans spend an estimated $2.6 billion on candy for Halloween, and the day itself has become the nation's second largest commercial holiday.
Wow.
Wow.
I'll be honest, that last bit about it being the nation's second largest commercial holiday kind of surprises me a little bit.
What other competition does it have, really?
You mean besides Christmas?
Well, Christmas is obviously number one, but I mean, like,
obviously.
What?
Valentine's Day, Easter.
I mean, you don't dress up in costumes for Halloween, or you don't dress up Thanksgiving. You don't dress up in costumes for Thanksgiving, or at least you shouldn't. Just don't get me started. But I feel like Thanksgiving is probably celebrated by more people than Halloween is, and I would personally think, especially if you're putting your best efforts into it, that the money you would spend preparing a Thanksgiving dinner outweighs the amount of money you'd spend on candy to hand out on Halloween.
Yeah, that's true.
But I mean, this is commercial holiday, so maybe they're not just thinking about food. Maybe they're thinking about merchandise like decorations
and costumes.
Yeah,
and
all kinds of things. And that's part of why it's fun that Spirit Halloween moves into specifically buildings that used to be other things but aren't anymore.
Yeah, like there's one by me that definitely used to be a Babies R Us.
That's part of the fun of Halloween now. I love that that has become part of it, is which vacant abandoned building in your town is going to host Spirit Halloween next year.
I remember there were so many jokes in the Disney community about when the big shopping center in Epcot closed down and people were immediately photoshopping Spirit Halloween signs on it.
Anytime anything closes, like I saw one the other day where the theater that is currently housing the Phantom of the Opera, since it's closing now after so many years on Broadway, that theater is going to become a Spirit Halloween. Anyway, so that is
Thank you, Jeff. What a delight.
Well, that is my deep dive on trick-or-treating specifically. I thought it was fun to do it because I don't know if you guys have noticed anything different, but obviously we've been through a pandemic in the last couple of years. So this year, I think, is probably going to be one of the first years in a long time where kids can actually get out and safely do trick-or-treating without having to think too much about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that, like, around, it's in cities, at least Chicago, I say, there's a lot more, like, trunk-or-treat activities, and I feel like because those are normally outdoors with a small group, a lot of those were happening last year, but hopefully we'll get back to proper trick-or-treating this year.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for that sweet time-turner there, Jeff. Hey! You can't fire me, I'm the producer. Well, that does wrap it up. And our podcast question this week is, we would love to hear your headcanons about the German Wizarding World, especially if your name happens to be Sophie. Or if you don't know much about Germany and you have specific headcanons about the Wizarding World in your town or city or state, we'd love to hear them. So drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets or email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or the podcatcher of your choice. Leave Spotify, Podcast Republic, Pocket Cast, wherever it is you listen to podcasts. They help new people find us, and we love to see your kind words.
Yeah, and you can also find us over on Twitter and Instagram at speakbeastie, on Facebook at facebook.com/speakbeastie, and on Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com. And you can support the show over on Patreon at patreon.com/speakbeastie. We have really cool stickers that go out once a month and some great coloring pages and extended conversations from hosts and all sorts of really cool content that goes up on Patreon. I'm Amy.
I'm Anne.
And I'm Jeff. Case closed.
Case closed!
Or is it?
So spooky!